It started in the late 1930s. In America, swing was king. People were having careless fun, listening and dancing to hits by Louis Prima or Benny Goodman. But in Europe, dark, threatening clouds of war were gathering. And it was in those uncertain times, in a small country called Czechoslovakia, in the town of Ivančice, that a little boy named Jaroslav Peprink wandered into his father's library. Little did Jaroslav know that at that particular moment his life was about to change.
I was lucky. I even regard it as a sort of act of providence that my father's library, there were three essential books, namely English dictionary, a book of grammar, and the book of conversation.
As little Jaroslav started to browse through the pages of these precious books, new horizons were unlocked in his mind.
I admit that I started in a rather unorthodox way, and the motive was no less unusual, namely a sort of romanticism. I felt attracted by foreign countries, by the stories of the American West, Jack London, books of travel. And that was the first impetus for professional interest in the language.
Frankly speaking, a little Jaroslav didn't choose the best of times to take a serious interest in English.
The following official communique has been issued from 10 Downing Street.
First, Britain and France made Czechoslovakia give up part of the country called Sudetenland to Nazi Germany when Jaroslav was 11. That was in 1938. The following year, German troops occupied the rest of the country, and when they invaded neighboring Poland, the then British Prime Minister, Neville Chamberlain, had little choice.
And that consequently, this country is at war with Germany.
So, officially, English became the language of the enemy. But Jaroslav's family refused to put up with that.
It was a war, so actually English was the language of the countries that were fighting for us. And in those days, people mostly listened to the BBC and not to Moscow.
I speak to you for the first time as Prime Minister in a solemn hour for the life of our country, of our empire, of our allies, and above all, of the cause of freedom.
So actually the war was, especially in the first period, mostly the matter of survival, thanks to the efforts of the English-speaking countries.
Caught by blast like some foul giant's breath, and blistered by the intense heat, London's firemen carry on. Here are heroes in action.
While the world powers were locked in the deadly struggle, life in a Nazi-occupied Czechoslovakia was hard, but relatively safe if you weren't Jewish, of course. But Hitler closed all universities and hundreds of thousands of young people were forced to work as slave labor. So did Jaroslav at the end of the war. He wasn't even able to properly finish secondary education. They sent him to an armaments factory to make components for German fighter planes Messerschmitt. Since he was still 17 and not yet 18 years old, he had to work only 10 and not 12 hours a day as his only slightly older friends. He devoted every spare minute he had to learning English from the few books available. He was driven by ceaseless curiosity,
an eagerness to understand better the background which is found in the fiction.
Finally, the war ended. The British Prime Minister, Winston Churchill, read this memorable message on the BBC.
Yesterday morning at 2:41 a.m. at General Eisenhower's headquarters, General Jodl, the representative of the German High Command, and of Grand Admiral Dönitz, the designated head of the German state, signed the act of unconditional surrender of all German land, sea, and air forces in Europe to the Allied Expeditionary Forces and simultaneously to the Soviet High Command.
Yaroslav, now 18, didn't have to take even final secondary school examinations that were traditionally required to enter college-level education. After 6 years of occupation, Czechoslovak authorities wanted to give an opportunity to every young man and woman eager to learn. So Yaroslav left small Ivančice to study English at Masaryk University in the closest big city, Brno.
When I entered the university, there were no entrance exams. I should explain that I started in 1945, that simultaneously with me, there were young people from the past 6 years who were not able to study at the university. So I think even for practical reasons, it was not possible. And second, it wouldn't be fair because some people had less opportunity to pick up the language. So they accepted everybody and hoped that it would sort out. And I should say that most students really persevered and there were hardly any dropouts.
The post-war optimism helped especially young people overcome many obstacles. Yaroslav, now a full-time student of English, was determined to master the language and get as much knowledge as possible about all the institutions and life of English-speaking world.
The three most vital sources were the tuition, but not what we now regard as practical classes, but lectures given in English by native speakers. Second, the availability in the British Council of foreign speakers plus foreign weeklies. And three, the opportunity for correspondence, because after the 6 years where people were shut off, so people were more willing to find friends abroad and were ready to write. And I was lucky that I found a student in Oxford, although she was not in the arts, she was in sciences. It was the more interesting because it was a wider field. And it was an excellent source for obtaining up-to-date colloquial English.
But after 3 brief years of freedom, history of Czechoslovakia took another sinister turn.
Gottwald therefore maintained a close contact with Moscow. Nosek, the central figure, used ministerial power to build up a communist manned police force. Only the usual plot remained to be unearthed. And the pattern of intrigue as familiar as the hammer and sickle is impressed on yet another country.
That was a communist coup d'etat. The new regime, closely allied with the Soviet Union, viewed anything connected with the English-speaking world with utmost suspicion. So in the eyes of communist authorities, all the students of English became automatically politically unreliable. The frontiers to the west were closed. Yaroslav was lucky enough to manage to travel to Britain for a summer school in 1948. He did finish his studies, but was sent to punitive military service for 5 years, of which he served four. Many years later, he found out that he was suspected to be a British spy. Yaroslav was eventually invited by one of his former lecturers to teach at Provincial Palatsky University, but only at a lowly position. Travel to the West was nearly impossible. Fortunately, the British Council was allowed to operate, albeit with a limited program, mostly inviting linguists and writers for lectures. These were one of the very few opportunities to meet native speakers. Yaroslav used them as often as he could.
I met a couple. The first was a writer who is known partly for literature, partly for his political views, Stephen Spender. The second is a woman writer, Elizabeth Bowen. I think she was dropped from the curriculums, but in her day and in wartime, she was very much appreciated and read. The third man was Mr. Hartley, although he would now be regarded as a lesser writer. He was not speaking without a paper, which was a rather disappointment. Much later, I attended a talk given by the author of Lord of the Flies, Golding.
Another quite influential, if not generally recognized, author that Yaroslav had the privilege to meet personally was Malcolm Bradbury.
Perhaps less well-known than Ray Bradbury, but he's also the author of an excellent textbook, History of Literature. And I was sitting incredibly for 4 hours and listening to his improvised talk. And when I said, because I felt I was occupying his time, I said, shouldn't I leave you now and you can choose a different representative? And he said, I like the symmetry. I said, what kind of symmetry? Well, I can see that your son is speaking to my son. And the fathers are speaking together. So it was very nice of him to view it that way. The very next day I was showing him around the town.
After the communist regime slightly relaxed tough rules on who could and couldn't publish, Jaroslav Pepernik was allowed to write his first textbooks. These became hugely successful and were used in language schools and universities all around Czechoslovakia. Their author became a true legend, but refusing to become a member of the Communist Party, he was kept at his lowly teaching position. It was only after the fall of communism in 1989 that Jaroslav Pepernik was raised to the position of a university professor. Ironically, very few of his countless students know how humbly his learning of English began in the distant 1930s, when Swing was king.
I started as a self-made man, and finally was self-taught.
I spoke to this cult-like figure in his office in Olomouc. Now over 90, Jaroslav Pepernik still exudes charm and infectious sense of humor. He continues to share the wealth of his knowledge on English-speaking world and language as emeritus professor at Palacký University. Vít Pohanka, Radio Prague.